Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Fortune, How Race Broke My Family and the World, and How to Repair It All. By Lisa Sharon Harper. Narrated by Lisa Sharon Harper. To all my relations who struggled under the weight of oppression, stretching your necks to catch a glint of warmth from the sun, behold, the sun. Foreword. Especially do I believe in the Negro race, in the beauty of its genius, the sweetness of its soul, and its strength in that meekness which shall yet inherit this turbulent earth. W.E.B. Du Bois. Captured in the 1920 publication Dark Water, Voices from Within the Veil, Du Bois continued his lifelong project of decolonizing false notions about people of African descent caught in the matrix of America's peculiar racial contract. It was Du Bois's calling to remind America of the imago Dei, the image of God, applied to all humanity, especially those living behind the veil. He wrote the credo as a declaration of belief and as a subversive act. When blackness is viewed through the lens of humanity, the American mythos is disturbed. Black people, according to America's mythology, must be framed by a lie for whiteness to flourish. Du Bois made the claim that people of African descent are worthy, have a story, have self-agency, and bring to the table a spiritual and intellectual genius. For those invested in the Confederate mythos, such rhetoric was unpatriotic and probably socialist. Du Bois and his contemporaries found this accusation thrown at all who dared to offer an alternative vision and account of America's history. Du Bois's declaration echoes in this publication by Lisa Sharon Harper. She, not unlike Du Bois, has crafted a credo that upends the American racial mythology for a vision of what can be versus false narratives of being great again. Lisa Sharon Harper mines the extraordinary story of her own family tree through the eyes of Sambo Game, Maudlin McGee, and their daughter, Fortune, who we would call Creole in today's verbiage. She held in her body the genius of Africa, the privilege of Europe, and the marginalization of gender, on the displaced colonial soil mistakenly called the New World. Lisa, like a modern griot, weaves a tale that is enlightening while simultaneously heart-wrenching. Hearing the story of Africans who survived the demonic cruelty of enslavement in America is to witness the brilliance and bruised grace of one's family tree. The spiritual ingenuity to survive while the demon of displacement attacks the psyche is a miracle academics and theologians fail to recognize. We stand at a peculiar moment in history in this land Du Bois called the yet-to-be United States of America, where black visibility is at its highest. Beyoncé Knowles is a global phenomenon. Serena Williams and Simone Biles are some of America's greatest athletes. Ava DuVernay has risen to cinematic prominence as the nation's premier socially conscious producer and director. Kamala Harris and Stacey Abrams are arguably two of our most influential political voices. The largest global movement to elevate the issues of black life was organized by black women, who declared Black Lives Matter. But with this heightened visibility, we are also in an unprecedented period of white backlash, where antebellum ghosts haunt both political parties. Though clearly these electors have found greater aid and comfort in one. Black death recorded on social media is the norm, and the denial of black pain is now a rite of passage for conservative politicians and preachers who seek power. Race, or racialized thinking, has fractured the global village, and specifically has poisoned the American Democratic Project. When I speak of race in this context, I am talking about the social construction of an idea that designated one group superior and another inferior. I am not speaking about ethnicity or culture with this statement. It should be noted that black people often use the term black interchangeably to describe a social construction or an ethnic connection. America's mythos banishes ethnicity and culture for our public discourse and replaces it with the nation's original civic sin of white supremacy, racism, and racial privilege. What is extraordinary about this publication is Lisa's ability to weave history, family narrative, theology, and creative nonfiction against our contemporary scene. If you ever have the privilege of hearing Lisa speak, you will quickly recognize that she is a storyteller and a writer who was excited about serendipitous historical details, but she never loses sight of the main themes and characters of her story. After this book, I was thankful. Thankful I had the privilege to go on this journey with Lisa's family. Thankful God keeps calling and inspiring gifted women and men to articulate a faith that is broader than Sunday rituals or Sabbath contemplation. Thankful I have a friend of grace and brilliance who is unafraid to speak truth in an era where lies, bigotry, and privilege are venerated. And thankful for the sacred synchronicity that created the tapestry to allow Sambo Game, Maudlin McGee, and a daughter named Fortune to produce a series of human resistors to the American racial contract, one being my friend Lisa Sharon Harper. Listen here, beloved, and let this story of family, race, and resistance create anger in your spirit and ultimately inspire your heart to join the work to heal our nation and eventually our world. Otis Moss III, Senior Pastor, Trinity United Church of Christ, Founder, Unashamed Media Group. Acknowledgements of Country. This book embarks on a pilgrimage through my family's story as a framework through which we all might sharpen our understanding of the story of race in our nation. Before we begin, I acknowledge the First Nations of the lands we will tread here. I honor the First Peoples of current-day Somerset and Wicomico counties in Maryland. They were the Nanticoke, Wicomis, Manakin, and Susquehannock Nations. They lived along the waters where they built villages, fished, hunted, and loved, and cultivated the land. They traded with early settlers, but were eventually enslaved, and many were sent to the Caribbean to slave on English plantations. They were, and are, here. I honor the First Peoples of Ohio County, Kentucky, the Chickasaw, Chickasha, and Cherokee, Aniunwia Nations, and the Shawnee, Shawanwaki Nation farther north. They were a woodland and mountain people who lived in log cabins, cultivated the earth for sustenance, and valued harmony above all else. They were and are here. I honor the First Peoples of Kershaw County, South Carolina, the Catawba, the Cherokee, the Kusabo, the Siwi, and the Wateree Nations. They were water people who lived along South Carolina's middle and upper country rivers. They stewarded the land until they were discovered, enslaved, and hoodwinked for their land. They were and are here. I honor the First Peoples of Barbados, the Taino, Arawak, and Kalinago Carib nations. And I honor the First People of Puerto Rico, the Taino, Arawak nation. People of the sea and explorers, the Taino are a matrilineal people who recognize both women and men as chiefs The Kalinago are fierce warriors who fought for their land but were overwhelmed by those who claimed discovery of them and their land. They were and are here. I honor the First Peoples of New York City, New Jersey, and Philadelphia. The Lenni Lenape Nation of the Algonquin-speaking peoples. A matrilineal people, the Lenape women managed the land, cultivating the three sisters, maize, beans, and squash. The men hunted and fished. When Giovanni de Verrazano made early contact with the Lenape in 1524, 30 familial clans thrived throughout the nation. By the time William Penn claimed Pennsylvania in 1682, only 3 clans remained. The rest had been decimated by disease, war, and famine. They were and are here. To the Nanticoke and Wicomas and Manakin and Susquehannock and the Chickasaw and Cherokee and Shawnee and Catawba and Kusabo and Siwi and Wateree and Taino Arawak and Kalinago Carib and the Lenni Lenape, I see you. I honor you. I thank you for laying foundations of harmony, balance, truth, and honor on this land. We thank you for stewarding this land where Creator settled your people. We bless you. We bless your elders, past, present, and emerging. Prologue. Have they come yet? Have who come? I was sitting on the patio of a retreat center in West Michigan with a new friend, Greg Ellison, professor at the School of Theology at Emory University. We had come to this center to be among spiritual leaders and discuss faith-based approaches to healing the world. The ancestors, he replied. I had explained to Ellison and a few colleagues with deep roots in the mystic tradition that I was about to embark on a pilgrimage to the place where the first ancestors in my family were brought to the U.S. as slaves from West Africa in the 1680s. Somerset County on the eastern shore of Maryland was not far from my home in Washington, D.C., but it felt a world away. I told them I was terrified to unearth the story of my family. It felt like I was about to push into the heart of American evil. I had heard rumors that this area in southern Maryland was like the Deep South, a breeding ground for hate groups holding on to racial caste systems. If you've ever visited Gettysburg National Park, one of the more striking things isn't the park itself or its famous landmarks. It's the locals, who proudly display Confederate flags in their front yards, or on their vehicles, or sell Southern trinkets in their antique stores, as if to dismiss the meaning behind the battle and the pivotal address that took place there. I had heard similar stories of Somerset County. Just south of the Mason-Dixon line, Somerset had pockets of Southern sympathizers. All I could think was that I, a black woman, was about to drive into the heart of hate to discover truth, beauty, and healing. I did not know what to expect or who from my past I might encounter. They will guide you, Ellison told me. 1 week later, I sat in my living room remembering his words. Despite his reassurances, I still felt fearful about my trip. Cable news droned in the background, something about Russia, something about collusion, something about America going to hell in a gift box from Trump Tower, and then I felt it. A presence. In my mind's eye, I saw her. A black woman with my shape. Curvy. Soft. A white apron over a dingy blue floor-length skirt. And a white head wrap. I don't know how, but I knew. It was Betty Game. my great aunt going back 8 generations. For many years, I had been researching Betty, her family, and descendants. Betty lived in Maryland in about the 1750s. She was a mixed-race, emancipated, indentured servant who had managed to buy land of her own. I had located tax records dating back to that era and found a single sentence explaining how Betty had refused to pay the extra tax required of free black women landowners. Further record digging showed that Betty never paid the black tax on that property. Betty stood in my living room like an 18th century black fairy godmother. "I will guide you," she said without words. As Ellison had predicted, my ancestors were helping me on my journey. Days later, I moved closer to the land of my American origin, with every revolution of the rental car wheels across the mighty Chesapeake. Suspended high above the water, this bridge was one of the longest I'd ever crossed. Crossing over the water, I moved toward the land from which my ancestors escaped. Records show that 3 generations of my family lived on the eastern shore of Maryland, some of them enslaved, some indentured servants, and some free. The 4th generation likely crossed the Chesapeake as indentured children, separated from their family by the movement of masters. They eventually lived free in Virginia. How they got there, the substance of their struggles, and how those struggles affected the generations that came after has been my journey for the last 3 decades. This book is the product of their pain and their push. Introduction. My mother, Sharon, leaned over my 7-year-old body as I lay on my side, curled up in bed. Eyes closed. I had just watched the 1st episode of the television series Roots, based on Alex Haley's novel. Huddled near the television set in our West Oak Lane neighborhood row house in Northwest Philadelphia. Mommy sang to me, "Wade in the water. Wade in the water, children. Wade in the water. God's gonna trouble the water." I didn't understand it then, but my mother's generation was made up of baby boomers whose parents had transplanted to the North during the Great Migration and had infused them with a power that Dr. King called soul force. It was gleaned from the blood-soaked earth of the South. They refused to be crushed by Northern oppression. Moreover, black boomer women and men were the 1st generation of people of African descent to live on this land with legal and systemic protection of their civil rights, since the Civil Rights Act of 1875 was overturned and Reconstruction crumbled. Now, under the cover of the Civil Rights Act of 1964 and the Voting Rights Act of 1965, which they had fought, bled, and died for, there was space to look back and remember. There, in my flower-wallpapered bedroom on East Walnut Lane, a sleepy suburban street where middle-class African-American children played hopscotch, Mother May I, red light, green light, and hide-and-seek from morning to night on sloped lawns in front of our row houses, there in the final hours of the day, once I'd had my bath and been tucked into bed, my mother sang, "Wade in the water, over me." With a hum that rose from deep within her soul, and words passed down through generations, she knit me together with my family's 289-year struggle on American soil. Previous generations did not have the luxury of memory. Under constant threat and suffering from constant trauma, family separation, and death. Many attempted to bury the past. My mother's mother, Willa, had suffered Jim Crow degradation as a child and escaped to the North as a teen, tucked on the second floor of a three-story South Philadelphia row house owned by her mother, my great-grandmother Lizzie, a home that offered northern shelter for three generations of her family. Grandmom Willa sang my seven-year-old mother to sleep with a song that attempted to lift her from the entanglement of black struggle into the world of make-believe. Willa leaned over Sherry's bed and sang, "I'm a little teapot, short and stout. This is my handle. This is my spout." But in the daytime hours, when daily trials and memories haunted mundane tasks, my mother remembers her mother's voice filling the house with the songs of Billie Holiday and Bessie Smith, like background prayers. Holiday's cover of George Gershwin's Summertime was her favorite. Willa sang of the morning her children would spread their wings and fly. "But till that morning, there's a nothing can harm you, with Daddy and Mammy standing by." Willa's mother, great-grandmom Elizabeth, was born in 1890 in Camden, South Carolina. I remember her at 90 years old, learning to walk again after breaking her hip and living with her daughter, my grandmother, Willa. I don't remember her ever uttering a word, but the elders say they remember a much younger Lizzie, the first in her family to seek asylum in the North, circa 1920. They say she moved through her days with a hum on her lips, often humming or singing "Precious Lord," a song written in her youth. "Lead me on, let me stand. I'm tired, I'm weak, I'm lone." Lizzie left the South and never returned, intentionally dismembered from her past. On that night, in January 1977, in the comfort of my mother's nest in our Philadelphia suburb, listening to my mommy sing me into the waiting waters of sleep, remembering Alex Haley's roots, Kunta Kinte and Yaisa, Binta and Omoro Kinte, and the last scene of episode one, where Omoro presents baby Kunta to the heavens, I was awakened to a truth that lodged itself deep in my marrow. I have a past and a people and a soul force that extend far beyond my life. The seed of this book was planted that night. For most of my childhood, I gleaned stories from my grandmother and my mother, but never wrote anything down. Then I saw Dances with Wolves. When I was a child, every week we visited Grandmom Willa and Grandpop Junius Lawrence in South Philly. As we entered their row house, I hugged Grandmom and asked her, "Where's the brush?" And she would point me to her dresser top in her bedroom. I'd run and get the brush and then climb behind her and sit against the wall on the back of the couch. Willa sat with her back between my legs, and then I ran the brush through her bone-straight hair. Brushing Grandmom's hair was like brushing the head of my 1970s hairstyling doll. I always wondered how her hair got that way. When I asked what she was, she got mad. She said, with definitive finality, "We're black. That's it." But one day in fifth grade, on the school playground, several friends shared that they were part Cherokee. I thought of my grandmother's hair again. The next weekend, when we visited, I waded into the troubled waters of identity again. "Are we part Indian?" I asked her with trepidation, not wanting to offend. But this time, she answered with a secret. "We're part Indian, But don't ever tell anybody. They'll think you're trying to pass for white. When my grandfather died, she gave me a beautiful Native American beaded necklace that she said he wanted me to have. I cherished it like a gift from the ancestors. I didn't understand the politics of passing at that time. I didn't know that Willa's mother, Lizzie, had passed at one point in her life. I didn't know what I understand now, that the political constructs of race in the U.S. are made up, illogical, and devised for one purpose, to determine one's place in a human hierarchy of belonging. All I knew was that I didn't want anyone to think I was trying to pass. I knew enough to know that would be bad. So I told no one. I never wore that beaded necklace in public, and I held my grandmother's secret until 1990. In the first moments of Kevin Costner's award-winning 1990 movie, Dances with Wolves, Captain John Dunbar attempts suicide. His desperate act opens an opportunity for the Union Army to attack. His bravery is commended with the opportunity to be posted anywhere he wants. He chooses the western frontier. From the moment I watched him step foot on the prairie, hands skimming tall prairie grass, tears streamed from an unknown place deep within my soul. A sense of longing rose from that place, longing for a home I'd never known, longing to be remembered with my people and my land, and I didn't know who we were, only that we were part Indian. I called my mother when I got home from the movie theater. On that call, I sketched my first family tree. One branch reached back to Leah Ballard, Willa's great-grandmother, my third great-grandmother, the last enslaved adult in our family. The other branch stretched back to the Lawrence family, my mother's father's patrilineal line, to Henry Lawrence. Henry fought in the Civil War, my mother explained. He was Cherokee and Black. That's all we knew. Later, my mother's brother corrected her. We were Chickasaw, Uncle Larry said, with his wavy gray hair tied back in a braid. So I came to understand the Lawrence line descends from people who were African, Cherokee, and or Chickasaw. I make no claim to be a member of any federally recognized tribe, be it Cherokee, Chickasaw, or any other. I only share the stories my ancestors shared with me. Mystery and breadcrumbs. I followed the breadcrumbs and found they were enough to sustain life. I wrote an award-winning play inspired by those breadcrumbs. Filled with my research and imagination of what might have happened, and pushed the wind down, imagined how my Black and Cherokee family came together and ended up on the Trail of Tears as family stories attempt to remember. In 2010, on the night I joined Ancestry.com, the doors swung open. I filled in the branches of our family tree as far as I could go. Hints popped up in the form of leaves. Those leaves led to an 1850 slave schedule for a Jonathan Lawrence, with several mulatto enslaved children. There was no listing of their names, only their ages. The pre-Civil War census listed the names of free people. Enslaved people were listed according to their declared racial status. B equals Black, M equals Mulatto, I equals Indian. All of Jonathan's enslaved children had an M next to their names. I scanned the ages. According to my mother, Henry should have been born around 1842. There was an exact match. On that slave schedule, listed as the unnamed property of Jonathan Lawrence, I was seeing likely evidence of the existence of the man who I had only heard spoken of, like the Greeks spoke of Hermes and Dionysus, mythical figures connected to their genesis. Here was the first evidence of Henry's reality.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?